Wait for it, wait for it, and we're live. Hey, all you crazy sci-fi and fantasy fans, it's time for your daily dose of shenanigans over here at the Blasters and Blades podcast. Just a couple of nerdy veterans and one chaos coordinator geeking out over our science fiction passions and fantastical fantasies, a place where magic is king, the sky is the limit, and space is the place. We are the podcast that puts the fun in dysfunction. So further ado, I'm going to say that this is Josh Hayes' fault. He jinxed me yesterday when we interviewed him, because we're interviewing these two episodes back to back, and he said, "You did such a perfect read-through of your introduction." It's his fault I messed up today. He cursed me. And with that being said, Bill, can you introduce yourself to our listeners and viewers at home?
Hi, I'm Bill Fawcett. I've been in science fiction for about 50 years now and a game designer for about 45 of them. And I've got a new book coming out, Never Again, and we're going to talk, I assume, because I'm also a military historian with about a dozen history books, nonfiction books out, a little about the science fiction, a little about the military, and a little about tanks and the armored soldier program.
It sounds like fun. Unfortunately, I was not smart enough to realize that this was your specialty, so I didn't bring anyone to keep me on track, because when we start talking history, sometimes I just go there and let the cards fall where they may. It's not my fault when I'm unsupervised. Sometimes the other coasts are like, come on, JR, not everybody likes history like you. But hey,
well, bore them all, because I love it too.
Yeah, we'll just go down together then. All right, the next part of the introduction, dear listeners, how we found him and his PR team actually reached out, and I'm glad they did, because he sounds like a really swell dude. Before we get started, though, we've got to do the religion questions. Are you ready for this, Bill?
Go ahead.
All right, Star Wars, Star Trek, or Firefly?
Firefly, not even a question.
That is an excellent answer. It is a criminal shame that they didn't finish it, but I guess that also means they didn't ruin it because they didn't get those extra seasons to go stupid. So did you watch it when it originally aired, or did you find it later?
I found it when it was first released here and had to get all the shows and put them back in order so it made any sense, and then I fell in love with it, mostly because of the talent involved. Really well done in the questions, you know. Just what was Preacher? We still don't know.
Yeah, there's so many answers. I would love if they would do some novelizations in the world, but I don't think that they ever did.
I was in the book business for 50 years, and we actually offered to do them. And Joe said, no, we don't want this. No, let people wonder.
I don't know. I mean, on the one hand, it keeps it as a cult classic. I assume after all these years, they finally earned the money they weren't earning initially, because I presume that's why they canceled it. But man, I want more. All right. And because we are polytheistic over here at the Blasters and Blades, Game of Thrones, The Wheel of Time, or Chronicles of Narnia?
I would go book-wise with The Wheel of Time. I would go movie-wise with Narnia.
Okay. That's an excellent answer. Do you prefer then hopeful fiction? Because I notice, you know, Game of Thrones tends to be a lot more grimdark.
I shouldn't say this, because Never Again is a rather dark view of the military life, because it's a desperate situation. But generally, I like positive endings. When I did a lot of books and editing with Dave Drake, we always argued over his dark view of the universe and my lighter view of the results.
Oh, you worked with David Drake?
And did a series called The Fleet, edited probably another dozen of his works when I was working with Bain and other companies.
Wow. Okay. That sounds interesting. So for
I miss him. We just lost him.
Yeah, I know. I just the working with him would have been, sounds like it would be a lot of fun. So for me, grimdark doesn't mean, you know, the hopeful doesn't mean it has to be all sunshine and roses. For me, the definition is there's a chance at hopeful ending. When you're in the dark tunnel, I don't want the light at the end of it to be the train coming to run me over. I want to know that there's a chance for a better on the other side to make the journey worth it.
I'm an American, not a Brit. I have endings. I mean, yeah. Brits have dark endings. Canadians don't have endings. I have happy endings. At least they accomplish their purpose for the cost it pays.
Exactly. So for me, as long as there's an ending that gives you some sort of a better future, I'm okay with it. But when it's just grimdark for the sake of grimdark, it's not really for me.
I've edited hundreds of books and never let that get through because first of all, it kills the series. Second of all, it depresses the reader. And I don't know anyone who reads to get more depressed.
I know Joe Abercrombie does some stuff that's really grimdark, and it sells well. I mean, people love it.
Grimdark, but the sacrifices are worthwhile. They're just painful. There's a difference between a grim dark ending where things go to pieces and things fail, and an ending that is a very difficult situation, but at least the story arc is closed and whatever the initial exchange of concept, you've finished, you've had a result that is at least able to carry on.
I could see that. I don't know. For me, part of my problem with Joe Abercrombie, at least, because I read his, what was the fantasy series? I'm drawing a blank what it is. I've read it, though. But I didn't like any of the characters. And that was part of the problem for me is, you know, I want to be able to like the characters. And all of them seemed like, you know, it was like pick the lesser of however many evils. And that really wasn't for me. I like when there's a very clear line in fiction between good guy and bad guy, because the world is gray enough. So in fiction, I want those absolutes.
There are villains. There are antagonists and protagonists. And the bad guys have to be bad guys as long as you keep in mind that in their mind, they're the good guys and you're the bad guys. And they act accordingly.
Absolutely. And so that's where kind of I draw the line. But all right. So now that we've got those out of the way, we do have our reader-sponsored religion question. So what is your favorite dinosaur?
Well, I would probably say growing up, it was a Stegosaurus. Not the type T-Rex like most, but Stegosaurus. But once the movie came out and they portrayed them as being, how do I put it, plucky. I like the Velociraptors. Anything that four or five of them can drive a T-Rex crazy, or even the Mega-Rex that they had in the third movie, they're my kind of dinosaur.
Yeah, I think I'm surprised. I would expect more T-Rex, but almost everyone is saying the Stegosaurus or the Brontosaurus. That seems to be the really popular two.
Well, I like the Titanosaurus because it's bigger than both, but yeah. Don't really get to see much of it in literature because you can't hardly fit it on a screen. It's about twice the size of a Brontosaurus.
Yeah, I could see that being a difficulty. And I don't, there have been a couple of people that have started bringing like Cretaceous tile type books back, but I just, there's not enough of them for me to get my fix. So, I mean, I've reread the Jurassic Park novels several times. Crichton nailed it out of the park with that one.
Bob Ashman wrote a book called Bug Wars. If you can get your hands on it, it's that the dinosaur-like creatures evolved into intelligence and moved into space. And what would their life be like?
What was the author's name?
Bug Wars.
The author's name?
Taking on intelligent insects.
Right, right. What was the author's name?
Robert Asprin, Asprin. The guy who did Myth Adventures.
I'm going to have to check that out. That sounds interesting. I did like the series Terra Nova, which got to explore some of that when they crossed over. Of course, it was on Fox, so we're all good shows go to die. So it ended it with more questions. I liked the Medieval. Did you ever watch that one? There was the British and the Canadian version that you really liked, which is basically time anomalies that let, you know,
letting them through and trying to deal with it. Yeah.
Yeah, I really like that. And then the theme of the great resetting to get the stuff back. There was a really badly done time travel movie where they would go back to like shoot the dinosaur, but it was very scripted. So you killed one that was about to die anyway. And then they changed the timeline by accidentally doing something, you know, they killed a butterfly or whatever.
That's actually licensed on a Dave Drake short story, The Butterfly Effect.
Okay, yeah, that's it.
And they were walking along the pathway and they weren't allowed to get off it and they can only shoot where they're supposed to, but one of them varies and he kills a butterfly, and when they come back, everything's different.
I remember that one because that was a really well done one. Mostly, I don't know, time travel, and when you start talking about those paradoxes, they just break the brain. So it's really hard to, you either do it right and it's very cerebrally complicated, or you don't do it right and it's too simple. Like, it's really hard to do those right.
It's difficult to do it right, and it's difficult to plot something that is readable and fun when you're dealing with paradoxes. Either you're too limited or it's too wide open, and either one of them makes for difficult novel writing.
Yes. There was one that did where they went back in time to like medieval France. No dinosaurs involved in that one. And it was like a love story at the end where they were doing fighting. But that's
when they got back and excavated the tomb and found they'd been there for 40 years. Yeah, that was during the Hundred Years' War. And it was very nice. Very fun.
The effect there was that, you know, there was no paradox because you went back the whole time, that it was always.
There is a theory you can't create a paradox because you're already there. It already happened. So we're what resulted no matter what you do.
You have the other one. It's if you go back in time to kill Lincoln or Hitler or whoever, if you go there to do a certain thing and you succeed, then you had no reason to go back. So you didn't go back. So it still happens, right? Like, that's one of the paradoxes. I don't know. It's all guesswork at this point.
By His Bootstraps by Robert Heinlein.
Is that a good one?
Oh, yeah. It's going back, doing something, discovering the cause, trying to stop yourself, and then realizing you shouldn't stop yourself, trying to stop yourself stopping yourself, and then going back to prevent the whole thing from happening to start with in a short story.
I'm going to have to check that one out. You're giving me a lot more to read. I like it. All right. So because we are affiliated with the Coffee Brand Coffee, Podcast Grunts is the discount code, people. Links in the show notes. So coffee or tea, sir, and how do you take it?
Herbal tea and okay. Just herbal tea.
So you don't add any sugar or honey or anything?
No. I eat enough candy to get fat. I don't need extra help.
We worked with some Brits when I was in Iraq, and they literally stopped in the middle of the day to have hot tea. And I'm like, dude, it's 140 degrees out. Drink something cold.
One of the biggest problems for medics and units in the Korean War and World War II was the habit of the British giving tea to anyone who's wounded as they're being taken out in order to calm their nerves and soothe them and everything. But it wreaked hell with stomach wounds.
Oh, yeah, I could see that. Wow. Yeah. But so the Brits were really weird about that. I mean, we worked with them. You deal with it. It was just a culture shock. But
we give them cigarettes. I'm not sure that was better for them in the long run.
We don't even do that anymore. We just put instant Folgers coffee. That's the extent of your vice in the MRE now. No more lucky strikes.
I can remember when there were three lucky strikes in every K ration.
One of my instructors when I was in college was a Vietnam veteran, and he still smoked Lucky Strikes because that's what he had gotten as his brand. And I was just surprised they were still in business, because you tend not to see them at gas stations or wherever you buy your cigarettes, but he somehow found them. So maybe he had
them. Not a big brand for him anymore.
Yeah. But all right. So tea, herbal. How'd you get into that? Is that something you've always liked?
No, that's something my wife said. You really should be drinking this. It's good for you. And since I always do what she who must be obeyed says, I tried it and discovered I like some of the different brands. And so now when I order a hot drink, it's herbal tea.
Okay. Nothing wrong with that. There's no right answers, no wrong answers. So you've been in the book business and in the creative industry for several years. So how did you first get into all things kind of nerdy with the sci-fi and the fantasy and all of that?
Well, I've been playing war games since the 60s, the old Avalon Hill games. I mean, I'm so old, I was excited when hexes were invented for gaming.
Oh, you predate D&D.
What?
So your gaming interest predates Dungeons & Dragons.
Oh, by far. And then when that was starting to come out, I wasn't involved until just about the time the first book set was just coming out. I'd been playing Micro Armor with them. I mean, you know what TSR stands for? It's Tactical Studies Rules, and it was for micro tank rules, micro armor rules. originally the company was founded for, and chainmail and the fantasy supplements continued under the same corporate banner. But that's how I used to play miniatures with them. I was a big Napoleonics miniature too, and knew a number. So when the fantasy game came out, one of that original group, a gentleman who worked for the IRS, in fact, so we had to be careful, began bringing up these mimeograph pages that were for the expansion. Well, it turned out it was D&D 2. And we began gaming, and then I began DMing and was involved with everything. And by the time things got rolling about 76, 77, I got involved. I walked in and said, "Can I help here?" And I was working part-time with Dragon Magazine and did something in the first 45 issues. Had some real fun with it. Did one that got me in a lot of trouble. I did an article on integrating angels into your fantasy world with stats, which if you've got stats, that means you can harm them. And I got to say, some fundamental people didn't like me for a while. And then after about that, I was working in probably one of the darkest and grayest industries in the universe. I was a training director for an insurance company. And I took a 3/4 pay cut to go help found Mayfair Games with a couple of friends. Never looked back and been working in my industry ever since and loving it.
So you know some of the OG creatives over there at TSR then?
Yeah, I just got back from GaryCon, those of us that are left. My wife is Jody Lynn Nye, the author, and when she was 19, she was dating Brian Bloom, the president of TSR. She typed the DMG Player's Manual and Monster Manual for Gary from his handwritten text.
Interesting.
I had notepads.
I had the privilege
of working with her. And he never even gave her a copy.
That's rude. I had the privilege of working with James Ward, so I've heard some of the stories about the old days.
Jim was wonderful. He was great. He was a lot of fun. Him, Frank, Skip, Mike, all the guys. There are so many stories we can tell about things that happened. And Kim Mohan and Joe Orlowski, Tim Kask at the magazine, too, when we were just finding our way and trying to figure out what to do. And, you know, we'd sit on Tuesday and go, "We got to go to press Thursday. Somebody figure out something we can put in the center of the magazine that's something other than an article." And we'd throw something together that was fun. And people go, "Hey, that's cool." And we're going, "It took a lot of beer."
I still don't know. So the week that James passed away, he had mailed me. He's like, "Hey, you got a package coming your way, JR." And I'm like, "Cool." And it gets there, and he spent whatever it cost to mail this. It's literally just 64 Crayola crown box. I have no note, no reference. I have no idea why he mailed me crowns.
I'm sure it was the beginning of something intricate, knowing Jim.
Yeah. So now I can't even ask him. I'm like, "I don't know what the heck you were doing," but it's just one of those things.
He was a good man. And he was never endingly creative. And he endured a lot.
I learned more about like writing fantasy from him than I did for my 4-year undergrad as a creative writing is my English focus. I mean, he just was a wealth of knowledge.
No observation on academics that I can make in public.
I wouldn't disagree with you either. So what kind of games did you make when you founded your own company? Because obviously, you know, you were doing something slightly different than what TSR was.
Well, we started with some inexpensive little bag games at $3 each, and then we graduated into box games. The one that put us on the map is when the war in the Falklands started, and we created a simulation of it, and we had our game out before the British made it to the island. And that got me some very unpleasant headlines in some English papers, too. "This game insults our dead." Got me a lot of drinks in Irish pubs, though.
I bet.
After that, we did some licensed things. One of the reasons I knew David is because we did Hammer Slammers, and we did Carolyn Cherry's Merchanter's War, and we did Forever War from Joe Haldeman, and Sanctuary with Robert Ashman that I mentioned before, which was the Thieves' World turned into a board game. So we did a lot of board games. We did some that were play-to-play, like the old Avalon Hills. We did a lot of cooperative games. We were doing some of the first cooperative games where all of you played against the game or all of you played against one person. And then later on, after we got kind of upset by being knocked out at the end of Rail Baron, On a drive back from a con in Michigan, we created the Empire Builder series where you drew on your, you drew your track, and that was very popular. And we did like 9 of those railroad games. They're still pretty popular out there. After that, or during that time, we founded the Rollades line, which were another beer-inspired name, but there were role-play modules and supplements. We did over 150 of them eventually. Everything from Dwarves and Elves to various adventures. I did the first one, Beastmaker Mountain, where I Tuckerized about half the staff at TSR at the time.
So when you were doing these, were you using the D&D rule sets, or were you making up your
own? Oh, no, this was very definitely for the original box set.
Okay.
And then D&D 2.
Okay.
And then, they were marked suitable for use with, but not approved by TSR, use with Dungeons and Dragons. And there was a big lawsuit, and we won it. We shouldn't have, but we did.
Okay. So do you still write for, I guess now the Wizard of the Coast owns them, do you still write gaming property for them?
I do a little gaming things occasionally. I just had a lot to do with the Black Ballad, which is a D&D spinoff. It's what you do when your group wipes out and everybody's dead. How you come back is you go to the place that is the land of the dead and work your way back to where you can come to the land of the living while running into interesting things like dead gods and clerics whose gods have died so they don't have a god anymore, and all sorts of fascinating convolutions of the land of the dead. Which was a lot of fun because writing for it was fun, and then listening to it was fun because it's got a soundtrack by original soundtrack by a group that comes with the game. It's actually, they're just delivering it. It was a very successful Kickstarter.
And what was this one?
Called Black Ballad. Rick Hines is the president of the company. And it's what your group does. It's a whole supplement set and extra stuff. And it's a whole world that you can take your party to for even a year or two after they wiped out somewhere else and start with the same characters, but in a new place, in a new environment with some very new and unique challenges.
Is there going to be any novelizations of that? Because I'd read the hell out of that.
Well, it's available now. If you just check Black Ballad online, you'll find it.
I will look that up.
I recommend it, obviously. I did a lot of it, too. And then I did online gaming, and I had a software company for a while. Did a RPG for AOL that was out about a week before they shut it, everything, all their gaming division down. It was really, they spent like $1.5 million on us doing it and then shut it down a week after it was released. It was kind of disillusioning. Worked with New World on the last of the zine games and actually wrote the script for the one that was never done. You probably don't even remember those. They were from the 80s. We're going way back now. Did some more role play games. The AOL game was in the 90s. And then after that, I got mostly involved in science fiction books and literature. I worked with publishers, and I created the worlds for, edited, and got writers to write in about 500 books worth of worlds for about 20 years, and that's how I made my living as sort of an adjunct editor to a number of publishers.
Nice. Good job if you can get it.
Yeah, like I said, in 1980, I walked away and took a 3/4 pay cut to work in my hobby, and I've never looked back. I think it's great. It give you some idea. I'm in my upper 70s, and I'd retire, except I'd do exactly what I'm doing anyhow, so why bother?
Absolutely. So, I mean, I like all the stuff you're talking about. I'm going to be looking up some of these short stories you mentioned and some of the games. I'm about to restart my gaming group. And so I was looking for something new to try. So, we'll have to check it out. When you're not doing, obviously, because we talked about this in the pre-show, you're not only doing, the gaming and the fiction. You also work as a military historian. So how did you get into that?
Always been an interest. I've been studying and writing articles on military history since the 70s. I think my first one was the cavalry plane at Austerlitz. I'm very interested in the Napoleonic period for a variety of reasons, mostly because it's a transition from the old to the new style of war, from from the formalized war with little armies to the national conflicts, and the change of tactics from basically a musket you can fire once every the flintlock or even slower. And then by that period, you're suddenly looking at large formations and things that can fire rapidly enough to stop cavalry for the first time. And artillery's become a queen of the battlefield. So it's a fascinating period where they hadn't always figured it all out right away. And some of the armies took longer than others. The Prussians had to get handed their head about three times before they decided to adopt some new tactics. But then they did so with a vengeance. And became very effective by the end of that period. So that always interested me. And then I went on, and I've done a couple of histories, worked in a civilian position during Vietnam, and got to know eventually a number of the SEALs that served in like from 68 to 72. And through the Fort Pierce Museum, by the way, you know, there's a U.S. Navy UDT and SEAL Museum in Fort Pierce, Florida, on the Atlantic coast there. And it's there because that's where the first UDTs were ever trained for World War II. And I had the privilege of working with another gentleman, Kevin Dockery, who does a lot of military books. And we interviewed 40, 45 Navy SEALs who served during that period. And they gave us some very insightful and exciting and very candid stories of what it was like and what they did and some of the things that happened in the early days before Vietnam became what a mass battle of everybody and what it developed into. It was a very different world then. And between them and other interests in the military history, I've done another additional books. I've got this theory that mistakes change history more than plans.
I believe
that when it's the mistakes people make that change history. So I have a number of books out there that are called How to Lose a War, How to Lose a Battle, How to Lose World War II, How to Lose a War at Sea, and How to Lose a Civil War. And it talks about all the mistakes and just how they influenced the course of the war. And I'll tell you, when you study the World War II, you could do, and there are whole books on just the mistakes Hitler made and why, if he hadn't, they might have won the war. So it's a fascinating topic, and still doing military history today. And that's really sort of what segued into this Never Again in the sequel books that we've got coming out this year. Looking at, let's call it a situation that's going to look awfully familiar after this week, because it's the Kurds who are a people that the British were mad at, so they didn't give them a country. Part of the Kurdish homelands where the Kurds live are in Iraq, Syria, Iran, Kurdistan, all this area. There's 40 million of them, all spread out in different people's places. They have a small autonomous region now in northern Iraq. But this postulates they found it, and I'm looking at what's developing, and like all of us, I was fascinated by armored warfare when I was reading, and of course, World War II and the sweeping armored formations and things like this, Blitzkrieg and all that. We're entering an era where the domination of aggression is giving way to the domination of defense again, as it cycles back and forth on times, with the accuracy of various weaponry and the ability of man-carried weapons to deal with something more powerful than themselves. And so I sat and thought about if the Kurds had a country, but they were surrounded by enemies, how would they survive? And they couldn't build more tanks, but if they had a weapon or weapons that could stop the enemy that the enemy didn't have at first, this would allow them to hold their own, to possibly survive. So I took, the super soldier program?
I'm aware of it, yes.
The powered suit. They really were beautiful. They would work great. You could carry 400 pounds, run 30 miles an hour, as long as your extension cord stayed in.
Yeah. That's the bottleneck of most modern technology is the ability of batteries to be compact. Yeah,
if batteries had developed, like, say, capacitors or phone chips had developed, we'd be able to run a car on something the size of our thumb because they haven't had a major change in 20 years. And we're due.
My entire life, we've heard that cold fusion was just 20 years away, too. So
I'm still waiting.
Yeah, me too. I'm 42. So
I want my flying car. Disney promised me when I was a kid.
Have you been to the Fort Eustis Transportation Museum? They actually did the jetpack. They built one in the 50s. The problem is the weight to carry it was so much for the minimal flight time you got that it was a tactical hindrance more than it was any benefit to the actual soldier. So they just canned it, but they've got it. I think, I don't know if it inspired the Rocketeer series, movies, comics, and all that, or if this was inspired by that IP, but it had a lot of resemblance to it.
Rocketeer's from the 30s.
So then it was inspired by the Rocketeer, not the other way around.
Yeah, the modern movies is a spinoff of the old Buckethead. He was a 50s television program. Okay. And the guy wore a helmet and flew around with a backpack. We used to call him Buckethead because they just, but basically it was a bucket with eye holes. It was low budget. They all were. The book postulates that a genius creates a battery that makes them work.
Okay.
And he isn't accepted many places. And DARPA's told to quit doing it. So they turn their prototypes over to the Kurds, who combine it with this battery and create a way to survive against a hostile world around them, particularly first an Iranian and then in the second book, Assyrian, and third book, Assyrian invasion. And you'd be surprised. I'm embarrassed at the parallels from Never Again, the first book, and what Israelis seem to be facing now.
Yeah, we stay away from the political because it's just, you know, I don't care if you're, you know, left, right, or commie, like whatever, your money's green.
It's not fun. I want to escape the real world.
Absolutely. But so, I will say from a just a historical geopolitical, we made lots of promises to the Kurds among other allies where we didn't really uphold our end of the bargain. And having worked with some of them while I was in Iraq, it was just, I could see them having reasons to be bitter and act in the way you're describing, just, you know, assuming history doesn't change up until your point of divergence.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. So what I've got is, if I've got a working power suit then and a great battery, then I can put a tank killer on one arm, at least from the sides and rear. And it makes for an interesting adventure, especially when there's a limited number of them trying to make a big difference. And it's after that, it's a cross between heroism and courage and frustration in many ways. And it's a story of the people, of course. It's not about the weapons. It's about the people and how they, in the Peshmerga, which is a Kurdish military, cope, basically.
There's that old expression, God made man and woman, Sam Colt made them equal. When the pistol first became, you know, more compact and, you know, shell casings, I imagine that same is going to be true when you start throwing in powered armor too, because the disadvantage sometimes that women have is they're smaller and they're not as strong. Smaller but stronger because of power armor. Now being smaller can be an advantage because they can get in tighter spaces, but they're stronger than the unaugmented because of power armor. It creates some interesting dynamics without, you know, escaping into the implausible.
Absolutely. In fact, one of the this is sort of a cross between Hammer Slammers and something that Harry Turtledove would do, in that we have multiple perspectives, points of perspective. Okay. Through the book, you follow four or five different people for different aspects of the war, including the commander in chief in the first book. And one of them is Nisti, and she develops through the books. She starts as a sergeant and ends up as a general in book five.
So,
and, because she's just as good as anyone else, even at 5'4" and tough. And you know the other group that powered armor would make a big difference to?
Who's that?
More mandatory retirement.
Oh, yeah.
if your armor is going to carry you, you can be a little achy and tired, but if you're a smart warrior, you're still going to be tougher than most people.
The one thing that I will say, when, you know, they've run into this problem a lot, every time they've done something to make equipment lighter, so you think, okay, the soldier's going to carry less, they just give them more to carry. So in aggregate, if you look from like what they carried in the Roman legions to what we carry now, the weight has never gone down. Like
Caesar's mules carried approximately 60 pounds, and their nickname for a legionnaire was the mules, Caesar's mules. And today we're carrying 45 to 60 pounds again. And I don't think Napoleon's troops were given approximately 50 pounds to 55 pounds each to carry. And then they pulled a wagon with food in it. So I think that's just universal. And once you get the powered armor, at least it's easier to move your stuff.
Yeah. Well, we have some of the stuff now where we've got the, it's essentially controlled by like an Xbox controller, and it's essentially like a six-legged dog almost is what it looks like, where they use it as a mule essentially to carry stuff. You factor that in with your powered armor and you could carry a lot of reloads too.
Oh yeah. You've got those, and you've got drones that can carry ammunition. They're big enough. And it makes a big difference. We try to encompass a lot of that, although it's still a story about people in a desperate situation and dealing with it, because that's a good story. And you do insights into the people as well.
So just, you know, from a terrain perspective, normally the Kurds were northern Iraq. Did you give them that region as their national borders for their country, or did you move them around?
Northern Iraq and eastern Syria and northern Iran, and that's basically the core on Kirkuk. It's based on reality. In fact, almost all the technology, except for two things on the suits, is functionally created today or being developed today and works enough it could do it. The batteries, and we give them a anti-tank weapon on the arm that's basically a small rail gun. And in reality, I don't think we can get a rail gun under 8 feet yet.
I mean, if you have a strong enough battery to compensate for the small capacitors, you actually could with modern technology.
Although firing a rail gun's a real problem because it's going out at such velocity. Think about the kickback.
Oh yeah, I was just picturing that in my head. I was about to ask you how you compensated.
You plant your feet and your suit freezes solid for about 20 or 30 seconds to absorb the impact. Okay. The problem is it's just like the old wire guided or laser guided anti-tank weapons from the 60s and 70s. That means you're staying there in plain sight of the enemy after you fire, unable to move.
Yeah, I can see that. And then the other part of that is planting yourself only works if you're on a ground, physically on ground that's conducive. But if you're on like a slick rock face, I mean, you could lock your body, but you're still moving backwards.
Yep. So that's a problem.
The reason I asked about the terrain, because there were talks about moving them all over, like making them their homeland move to different parts of Iraq where they thought it might be easiest to set up. So we were all over the place originally and what our plans were.
Yeah, no, they never moved.
Good.
They never moved. The only thing that happened is Iraq and Iran went up and grabbed most of their oil fields.
There are some places in the northern Iraq regions that are just like Mother Nature created the perfect, you know, redux of Thermopylae with some of the places you're going through. I remember when I was going through northern Iraq, we were doing a run up to Mosul. And there's this one where there's this mountain and it's like a 45 degree incline and then it levels up at the top, but you're cutting in between two. It had been blasted many years before we were born, but you're going through this divide. And I'm just thinking if they were smart, they'd ambush would be waiting for us as soon as I crested the hill. And so it would have been brutal.
Yeah. The Kurds have a phrase for their being there and what they have around them, and it's called no friends but the mountains, and they count on their mountains to protect them.
But yeah, and if you stop a convoy in the right place, or just any soldiers in movement, you trap them in place by, you know, you take out the front, take out the back, and they're not going anywhere, and you can pick them off at your leisure. And when you have height as your advantage, It allows you to shoot farther too. You know, I mean, we've shot 2 mile sniper kill at this point, but he was from such an extreme elevation. So you give that to your wire guided tank killers and suddenly they might not even be visible to the naked eye at that point.
Yep. Yep. It's, very much a matter of terrain, and the terrain like that is what let them stop ISIS. And before that, the British, and before that, the Russians, and before that, everybody back to Alexander the Great. You know, Saladin was a Kurd.
I did not know that.
Saladin was a Kurdish general. They were considered elite troops in the Persian army, or the Ottoman army.
So I'm going to want to dive in, but we're going to pause for a moment while we play the commercial, and then we're going to dive right in because I want to hear about these characters and what you're doing, because I know I'm going to go buy it as soon as it goes live, which will be the day we're airing this, because this is right up my alley. Like, you're hitting all the right nerd buttons, sir.
Well, thank you. April 19th.
All right.
Alien Days is a multi-author anthology with thrilling tales of aliens, invasions, artificial intelligence, friendship, deceit, and extinction. This combination of stories makes it a must-read for science fiction short story fans. This anthology features Nebula and Dragon Award nominees, Amazon bestsellers and award winners, alongside rising stars in the science fiction genre. Let the authors take you on adventures through dystopian worlds and far-flung planets that will stretch your imagination. Welcome to Alien Days.
All right, thank you for sticking with us through that commercial interlude. So you said you had multiple POVs for this series. How many characters are we following? Is it like a real ensemble, or is it just like a core group of three or four?
Well, about halfway between. You start by viewing it through the head of a colonel who's the commander of their only armored brigade, trying to stop a Syrian column that's trying to punch through them and ending the war basically when he does. And then a tragedy occurs, and that's when he gets introduced to the armor, the development of this by basically an Elon Musk type character. And you see some from him, and then you see some from the point of view of an older top sergeant who knew him when he was a lieutenant and was his father's aide before him, etc. And then you go into the Iranian attack that occurs on the Kurdish Republic. And in that, you've got views of three of the people who are wearing the suits. You've got him. And you've also got views by the villagers who are part of the Peshmerga militia, who are having to stop troops with just what they could, their smaller weapons, and holding the mountains, which we discussed. And then you've also got a character who is a major who's in the line trying to start the bulk of the army so that the powered armor guys can get around on the flank. So I'd say there's about 7 points of view. It's not too confusing. And then the final point of view is the security chief for the president of the Kurdish Republic, who basically is, I won't ruin it, but let's just say he's sent off to take out the main character that was commanding the powered suits because the president feared him. And instead he gets converted and becomes his security man, because if he could get to him, he needs better security. So we've got basically 5 different combat points of view, plus 1 science point of view, scientist point of view. And one guy who's sort of behind the scenes watching what's going on.
So when did you start writing this series?
About 2 years ago.
So sat phone, the Starlink was around at that point in time. So do you factor in the ability of modern cube satellites as far as to enable communication in regions that were previously unable to get reliable comms?
Oh, absolutely. But I also factor in the fact that if you're sending a signal, someone can locate you.
Okay.
And that's a problem. So what we use is something that is available, but we moved it up a little bit. And that's burst broadcast technology.
Okay.
You put the message you want together, and then it goes out in a fraction of a second every couple of minutes, and then goes to everyone else, or every two or three times a minute, so that it does, it's hard to pinpoint a single location of a person. And then you have fluctuating frequencies so that it's hard to keep following them. And of course, in book three, the problem is somebody figures out how to do that, and they have to find a solution that helps them to continue to have their advantage of mobility and firepower. They're basically heavily armed light infantry. They're not armor. They can't stand toe-to-toe with the tank unless they're on the side and he doesn't see them at first. They do find a solution. It's kind of an interesting one. I won't give it away. But let's call it confusion to the enemy.
Did you have them using, was it for the Syrians, or are they using the Russian-made stuff, or did you set it far enough into the future that you could?
American-made.
They got American-made?
Yeah, there's a whole lot of doing things we wish our country was doing by them with our equipment, our old equipment.
Well, we left a lot of it in Afghanistan, so there's certainly room even on the modern timeline to make stuff happen. So are they in there with Strykers? You have them with Bradleys, Abrams? What are they using?
Well, not counting the powered suits, they have a regiment of Abrams. They have about a large number of Bradleys. They have a number of fighter aircraft, although aircraft, again, are a little hazardous to be up in for a number of reasons, as they found out in current wars. But their favorite thing is they bought all the surplus A-10s the United States Air Force and Marines and Army had, and that's the core of their airstrike capability, the old A-10s, the Warthogs.
Okay.
And they love them.
There's no reason not to. So we're recording this on the 14th. It's airing on the 19th, just for point of reference, April 14th, April 19th, for people listening in the future. In the news yesterday, it was announced that the British military fired a laser into the skies to take out satellites for the present conflict in Ukraine, which if you had told me the day before I read that article, I would have told you that was science fiction. So are you able to incorporate some of the new developments that are literally happening faster than we can track? Are you just making assumptions?
No, actually, we try very hard to incorporate existing, or even in some cases, dumbing down existing so that we aren't telling anything. I have a co-author on a couple of the books, and he's a 24-year veteran. Actually, I have two co-authors, and she's also a 20-year veteran. And we try to not give things away that we probably shouldn't mention even casually. But we do have, because of the batteries and the ability to charge them with solar panels quickly, we do have functional rail guns that are very effective and very long-ranged, working very well. We're on the scale of a local conflict, we're less concerned with knocking out satellites, because the Kurds are getting information under the table from the Americans, and the Iranians are getting it under the table from the Russians. So it's sort of an equality of information there.
So with the added battery tech, that could be more than just the suits. I'm just thinking what you could do if you look at the weight of the battery for some of the armored vehicles. If you didn't have that weight, that's more armor. It's more, you know, more capacity for armor or weapons or whatever. Do they start retrofitting, or do they just take the equipment as is and only apply it to the suits?
You were book four.
Okay.
Describe book four.
Okay. That's definitely interesting.
Which is called Forlorn Hope. And
I love that title.
Yeah. There, never again, no fail, no further, and Forlorn Hope are the first four books. And they'll be out in April, May, July, and September.
So how deep do you see yourself? Are you going to do the next David Weber, where you got like a bazillion books? Are you going to keep a tight arc?
If we sell a bazillion copies, we'll do a bazillion books.
Okay. Okay.
I'll take 20% of my buddy Dave's sales. And I'll be
So, you know, one of the things that tankers love to see themselves represented in. There's two groups of people that love seeing themselves in print, and it's the coasties because they almost never happens, and it's the tankers because they're in love with the smell of their own, you know, whatever. I'm an instrument, so I can say that. On a scale of zero to holy crap, this is Fiddler's Green, how happy are the tankers going to be with the way you're kicking their ass with these suits?
Well, the ones that on the bad guy side are not happy at all. But the good guy side, you still need your armored function. You still need your heavy armor to make a penetration once you have used your infantry to soften or disorganize your opponent.
Okay. Yeah,
no matter how functional you are, highly armed infantry is not a schwerpunkt weapon. It cannot penetrate. You still need something to break apart that front once it's been torn up in the rear. And so the tanks remain vital. It's just that the tanks are, in this case, the suits are on their side. So they really like the idea because it eliminates yeah. a lot of the other tanks.
So what tactical organization did you use for these suits? Are they operating in like four-man fire teams and independently? Are they doing sort of A-team, B-team like the Green Berets?
Four-man fire team, eight-man units, platoons of 32, and brigades of 400.
But I mean, are they operating independently because they're essentially a force multiplier?
They depending on what's going on and how they're attacking, they the smallest unit they tend to scout is four people.
Okay.
Because you want fire support, and if half your suits lock up when you're taking on something, you want the other half to be able to protect you, et cetera, is four. A lot of when you're deploying it, say, to reinforce a unit that's under pressure and you're trying to get someone there quick to reinforce, you're probably looking at anywhere from 32 to 64 GOGs. By the way, they're called GOGs, General Ordnance Garments, and that's what's how they're shipped. You know how tanks got their name?
No, I don't.
All right. They were built in England. Remember the big ones that had the giant wheels on them?
Yeah, I've seen the historical progression of them.
Well, to ship those on ships, they put them in crates, and they had to sneak them over. And they were labeled water tanks whenever they shipped them anywhere. And so in all the communications and in all the information and all the exchanges, they called them water tanks. Are the water tanks there? We're developing a new kind of water tank, et cetera. So eventually it became, have the tanks arrived yet? I'm waiting on my tanks, et cetera, to keep the Germans from understanding what they're doing, because when they first appeared, they were a tremendous shock. And so the name stuck because they were labeled water tanks.
I did not know.
That's why we call them tanks.
It's a nice little bit of trivia.
And these are called... They were shipped in boxes that said General Ordnance Garment, big G. As the military labels things.
So yeah, not the most creative.
And when the Kurds get them, they say, oh, they shipped us GOGs. And I must admit that is not entirely by mistakes. It's a little biblical. The Gog and Magog are.
Okay.
In volume 5, the massive armament, General Ordnance Garment, the Magogs appear. And that's what you're asking me about when we start making use of other weaponry and put them in things other than body suits.
Are you familiar with the heads-up display that the Army was developing to try to essentially make a HUD?
We have it incorporated into this. There's a HUD and a mapping HUD and a 360 display in your helmet that can be adjusted to see all or part of it. But we're using the flyer version where it sends it into your eye. It's not really projected out. It's into the open eye.
How did you get around the headache, the migraines that it caused, the dizziness because of the way your eyes interpreted the data? Did you compensate for that with future tech?
I said that it was no longer a problem because I write fiction.
It works for me. But it was addressed because there was a reason the Army.
Oh, I know why it was dropped.
Yeah.
I knew some of the people who were working for DARPA at the time, and couple of them tried it. And, you know, they tried driving a car, using that to project what they were seeing, you know, with a helmet on. And they were throwing up on the wheel.
I believe it. I know some of the soldiers that were involved in the test unit at the time. Did you incorporate NVGs then with the night vision capability to give them that as well?
Night vision, infrared, magnification, and outline retention, so that you can, you know, the rifles, you can lock it on an outline and pull the trigger and it'll stay on it. Even it'll move to it instead of, you know, well, we include that, we power that in the suit, so that one of the things you can do with your small caliber weapon is pick four or five targets out and then start shooting, and your arm sort of moves on you to go to that, because we're putting several hundred servos in every unit.
That's convenient. So did you, I mean, obviously we have communication capabilities like with Blue Force Tracker and whatnot to allow you to communicate and link in.
And also status report on those you command. You can tell if their suit's functioning and if they've got a pulse or not.
So you incorporated all of that into these new suits as well?
Yes.
That's interesting. That was one of the bane of my existence, is even when I was in, you know, Mosul, Iraq, in southern Kuwait, the command could check up on me like, dude, just let me do my thing. Do you deal with what
They even have cams that can be forwarded, which is the bane of everything.
Oh, good God. I'm just imagining the level of micromanagement you get with that.
Fortunately, I have very noble and intelligent officers who don't do this. And the first lieutenants tend to be told to be quiet. Or the second lieutenants tend to be told to be quiet. So it works out.
Are there any things in these suits that require a human operator, or could one of them be
No. Very much so. Very much it's a human experience. There is no AI.
Well, I was just thinking
the suit doesn't talk to you and it's not an AI.
I was wondering if one could be slave to several and you could, you know, have one guy walking and the others just sort of mimic it, kind of thing. You see that sometimes in sci-fi.
I suppose it would be possible, but generally if you've got a warrior in it, if he's functional, it's good. If he's not functional, he wants to get out or he's dead, and you have to deal with keeping the enemy from getting the suit.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. When you have that many unaccounted for, if something goes wrong, you
don't want in the first four books, we don't want anyone getting a copy of it, because they're not even sure what they are. The Iranian soldiers call them demons, the jinn.
Yeah, some of the best nicknames that military people get from their enemies. At one point in time, they called the Striker Whispering Death, because unlike the Bradley or the Abrams, they couldn't always hear it coming. So I imagine you would get some of the same effect. How much of the local culture of the northern Iraq region did you incorporate into building this? Was it
a fairly good deal, actually? There's a Master Chief Dennis Chalker, a former BUDS instructor, spent several years there training the people after he got out of the SEALs, out of six. And he helped me to reflect a lot of attitudes and a lot of the good things. Now, these are much more noble people than he described them, just as characters in our military, and our stories are sometimes better than some of the people we worked with. But yes, we tried to reflect the culture. We tried to reflect the fact that there was still nepotism, and that there were people in because of politics, which has always been a problem for the Kurds, is the important families always got the better jobs, whether they were capable or not, et cetera.
That's a human thing, not just a Kurdish thing.
You know, and so we include a good deal of that. We also include the fact that there is a good deal of unity of feeling and a willingness to sacrifice that we've seen time and time again. That's how they took out ISIS. That's how they survive.
They are definitely a hardy folk.
The names are real Kurdish names, and the places are real Kurdish places. And like the war, the first book, when it's over, they call it the Nurwaz War, which is one of their big holidays, because it was begun. The Iranian attack began on one of their holidays.
Okay, I can see that happening. When you were coming up with these tactics, how far back? Because like I know when I was in Iraq in 03 and then again in 05, we were running gun trucks, the convoy escort platform. So we jokingly said we ran an escort service. Part of the time, because we don't maintain certain skill sets between wars, I ended up going back to some of the old horse-mounted cavalry manuals to start figuring out some of the tactics that we ended up using and helped write the SOP for the 101st. So when you started thinking about how to use these, did you tie into your knowledge of history to say how this might be applied, or did you try to get completely creative factoring in the new tech?
Oh, no, I stole from the best. I want so you to think about it. I've got light, fast, ranged troops that are organized in groups, taking on slower or bulkier forces and regular infantry in other places, and they're coming out of the steppes of Asia. Remind you of anything? Like maybe yep. Genghis Khan and the Mongols?
I'm thinking that.
Did I mention the name of the American father and Kurdish mother who becomes the main character in it? Is Timoshin.
I like it. So do you have any... So
yes, I borrowed heavily from Mongolian tactics because they're perfect for this situation.
This is almost textbook proxy war that you're describing. So most of the time when those proxy wars happen, countries that aren't there are there. So do you have any engagement where, you know, maybe U.S. forces or British forces or even the French Legion, where they participate, or do you keep it localized with your story?
We keep it somewhat localized with a couple of exceptions. Russia meddles and supplies a lot to the Syrians. Book three is basically involving a Russian-financed invasion with mercenaries. A lot of Russian mercenaries. There is American support, but it's not directly and completely with the government. To keep it from becoming a world-scale thing right away, we make Russia as crippled as it looks like it's going to end up anyhow. China having internal problems and the United States going isolationist, which is why they turn the suits over when they don't think they'll work to the Kurds. And a lot of people who are disillusioned with that end up supporting the Kurds one way or another.
So sort of like Ukraine had the foreign legion, they sort of showed up. You kind of did the same thing?
Yeah. There's book three has a very distinct section on that, where there is the master sergeant who worked with DARPA, who helped develop the suits, comes over to see how they're doing and has gotten to know of a bunch of the new people, and particularly some that have volunteered from other countries. He's there as an observer. He's in one of the suits because they wouldn't let him go up without it. And then they come under fire and he has to make a decision. He's an American soldier. We're not at war with Syria in this book. What does he do when the people he knows and cares about are being shot at and he's carrying all these weapons and he has to make a decision?
I would not want to be in that position because I know what I would do, generally speaking.
Well, that's it, but there are some pretty strict laws about being in one army and fighting for another when you haven't been told you can.
Absolutely. So
it's a quandary for this gentleman in this story.
Do you factor in like active camouflage? Cause that's something we're working on already.
Very much active camouflage and color changes. In fact, I have a fun scene in one section where they're trying to basically intimidate a bunch of people that are in a large armored unit that's settled down, and four of them approach it in their powered suits, and they paint their suits bright. They change their camo to bright neon yellow and shoot at them, and then flee into a patch of trees and go to full camo where they can't be seen. And then another group of four of them, 500 yards further along, turns theirs back to bright yellow and starts shooting from there. So it looks like they're jumping from place to place, and these guys have the ability to teleport or something, because all you can see are the suits, and all of a sudden the four yellow suits are over there, and then the four yellow suits are further on over there, and then they're over there behind us. What's going on? These guys are Dijin, they're demons.
That is
so
an interesting.
We have fun with the camera along with just hiding with it.
That's an interesting take on the shock and awe tactics. That's very creative. I'm just pissed I didn't think of it. So when you write these books, because obviously you're writing tactics, did you do the sand table approach to map it out, or did you just keep track it all in your head from your years of wargaming?
Hand-drawn maps.
Okay. I can
and
see
we,
this.
We also create our own timeline. The entire books are done by location and date instead of chapters. The chapters are broken down into sections by location and date. And the dates start on year 9, the 9th year of the Kurdish Republic.
That makes sense. Makes it easy for you not to get pinned down and have the books kind of lose relevance.
Yeah, I mean, these will never be obsolete.
Yeah, I'm just thinking like technically Demolition Man, which was the far future, is next year. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some of that stuff doesn't age as well if you're not careful. Team Yankee, excellent armor book, doesn't age well because of, you know, it was written for the time. And so you've kind of guarded against that. I like it. Are these books going to come out in audio?
Yes, they'll be out simultaneously. And probably about a month after release, they'll be out in audio.
So are you doing this with Bain, or are you doing self-publishing for these?
Chris ones? Kennedy Publishing.
Okay. Okay. I'm aware of him as well. So right now there are the books that are coming out. You've got at least 4, because you've mentioned that, you know, hopefully they keep selling so you do more.
It's a 12-book arc if we do them all.
Do you foresee potentially, you know, using your experience to turn this into a gaming module? Because that would be fun to play.
Yes. The answer is yes. Absolutely. In fact, we've talked about an armored combat role play game where you're in one of these suits and you have to pick your equipment. And it's sort of like a short-term, near-future mech warrior.
Yeah. I'm here for it. The fun part would be trying to come up with stat blocks for these suits to make the system work. So where did you get the genesis of the idea? Like, obviously, you took a point in time and you moved it forward for the suits. Like, all of this stuff mostly exists as is, but what made you sort of formulate that into what it is today?
Reading military research in the magazines. Had this and that. This is over here. This is over there. This is there. Wow, if this went to there and this went to there, then this could happen. So that would mean, and it just sort of fell together into a suit. We also have a 4-inch by 4-inch drone because of the good batteries that can fly independently for 90 minutes and send a signal, burst signal back to you. That you can use for A, targeting, and B, scouting on the shoulders starting in volume 2. Because we see what's going on in the world and how it's doing, and we incorporate it into how we would use it in the future. And I think the one of the things we're going to find is that along with the big drones as weapons, the miniaturization of drones is going to allow individual soldiers with a little eyepiece or something to be a lot more effective and in a lot less danger until they're ready to be, if we can do it. I think the Ukrainians are actually working on something similar to that now.
So when you have these, because the suits can sort of be you can almost make them God in the machine kind of thing if you're not careful from a storytelling perspective.
Oh, no, they have many, many flaws. First of all, you run out of battery in 8 hours. You can only carry a few batteries with you. Second of all, you freeze up when you fire your main weapon that can handle anything big. First, also, you've got the same ammunition limit as other people. There are 3 weapons on it. There's a firing bullets. There's a bandolier with a limited number of grenades that, because you have a powered arm, you don't need a mortar. You can throw them.
Oh, shit. And, I didn't think about that.
And then you have your anti-tank weapon. And but each of them has their own drawbacks. You have to you have limited range, you have exposure, and you have the freeze to fire the weapon that makes you vulnerable to the opposition. And you can't put enough armor on it to stop a 50. A 30 might chew through, and a 50 definitely will, no matter what you've got on there. And it's not like a knight set of armor. It's actually got to be somewhat flexible. Now, we have materials that harden when impacted. I progress those a bit and put them on the suits. But you can stop small caliber, but you're still vulnerable to larger caliber weapons. These are not iron suits that you can walk through in. It is an Iron Man. It's soldiers with some extra edge, making the best of it at great risk and sometimes sacrifice.
So modern fire teams, you have the rifleman, the grenadier, the saw gunner, and you know your team leader. Do you keep that kind of specialization, or because each suit is
currently independent? We're going to that in the fifth volume when we're going to introduce a range of weapons on it. We actually begin with it in the third volume, where we talk about some specialized weapons for use up close against tanks and whether they'll work or not. And they're testing them in it. And then we're also looking at some area weapon stuff that you would do on it, where you could basically put out, if I can throw grenades, I can throw half a dozen frag grenades that are electronically set to go off in the air. It's a whole lot like a certain piece of outlawed munition right now that we can't drop. But have.
Yeah. You could also quickly deploy, like, I'm just thinking like claymores and such as well. I mean, something similar.
Oh, yeah. Lots of that. That is quite possible and is done. And also, if you can run 30 miles an hour and jump 20 feet, you're real good at demolitions.
I bet. So, when you are writing this and you're doing the testing, did you work with, aside from the Navy SEAL that's retired, did you have like a team of military experts or just rely on your own, you know, historic training, which I would argue?
I ran everything by at least six different people on a regular basis of how would this react? And is this right? And is this, what would be done? And am I doing something stupid in this firefight? That kind of thing. Because even I've edited enough vets to know that when they get out of their area of expertise, they can have a problem with that. And since I'm not a combat veteran and don't claim to be, I make sure that I consult the ones who are to make sure I'm not doing something that is ridiculous or wrong or just not feasible or that someone just wouldn't do. So, yes, I have a whole team of retired and ex-military, and I also run it by my adopted son, retired Colonel Fancher, U.S. Air Force.
One of the things that I remember we were doing the train up to the original invasion, because we were guardsmen, they had us play the Op 4 because they figured the guards would be just as incompetent as the Iraqi army. But I think there's, on one hand, there is some truth to that because of the way the class structure got in the way of military excellence. But if you're taking it to the forward, if you make them that level of incompetent, then you don't have a series because they roll over pretty quickly. So how did you make the competence believable but still upping from where they are as it stands to where they need to be for this story to work?
Well, two factors. There are professional soldiers in every army, even bad armies, and they can be a real problem. And second of all, quote the Russians, quantity is its own quality. And if you've got half a million Iranian soldiers taking on 150 or 100,000 Kurdish soldiers, even if the Kurdish soldiers are braver and more valiant, at some point, only so many are in contact and you're going to wear down the Kurdish force.
Okay, that works. I know there's sometimes, you know, part of it is the othering of the enemy, so it's easier to kill them. It's why we, during the Cold War, shot silhouettes of Ivan. Even now we shoot silhouettes, they just paint them to look like insurgents. You kind of get people used to not thinking of the other guy as human. But I imagine just thinking more globally from what you would need to do to write convincing enemies, that's a weakness that you kind of have to factor in, because if you just assume they're stupid, then they're not good bad guys.
Oh, no. In fact, the main theme in the first book is that they have to disrupt command and control because, in other words, there's no way they're going to be able to deal with the other side with the numbers that are available, even with their suits. They have to use them to disrupt command and control, in fact. In other words, an organized army is going to roll over them whether or not they're braver than heck or not.
Do you show any point of view from the enemy side, be it Russian or?
Yes, we follow the commanding general, General Davoud, of the Iranian invading army. And we follow the person who is organized and supplied the mercenaries in the third scenario. And in the second scenario, which is basically, if you beat the Iranians up but don't invade them, the next thing they're going to do is dump their nukes on you.
Yes.
And they have to stop that. And this, you see the point of view of each of the locations that the GOGs have to deal with, how their commander deals with it when half the army is denying they exist and other half scared darkening their pants about them. So we get a number of looks, and then we drop back to General Davoud on a regular basis, who is the head of the bad guys for the first two books.
That's the one thing that's got the Kurds would have going against them in this scenario is when they're in the mountains, they have tactical advantage, but Iraq and southern Iraq is very flat and makes great targets if you control the skies.
So Western Syria.
Yeah. So it gets it's interesting. Did you have fun at, you know, factoring in how to compensate for that?
Well, we the flat basically means you have to form a defensive position. You can't count on the mountain to defend you. You have to find somewhere, rivers, hills, mountains, not hills, mountains, but buildings, cities, etc. And the main effect the mountains have in the first book is the fact that it's a force multiplier that allows the well-armed and supplied militia, who are the veterans and the local villagers, to stop a significant force of Iranians because they have to come down the valley and deal with them. And they have to use their artillery to drive them back, et cetera, drive the Peshmerga back, et cetera. So it gives the militia a more realistic role in slowing down part of it. Not successfully entirely, but slowing it down. But I don't want to give what happens away.
No, we don't want spoilers, but I'm definitely going to be reading. Let me throw while we've got you talking. So this is the cover art, dear listener, if you're watching. This is the GOG suit.
You'll see the rifle on the left that you can target with, and the rail gun on the left arm, and which is on the right of the picture. And then you've got your suit with your HUD and your specialized lenses, and then your specialized communications at the back of the head that does the pulses and everything. And then hundreds of servos under the suit. And you'll notice that this isn't totally accurate, but you'll notice that it's not solid armor. There are places where it is simply covered by that solidifying thing that'll stop small caliber and shrapnel, but not big caliber.
Yeah, I'm digging it. I like the tanks that you see in the background. And you can definitely see the mountains.
We have fun with the name, too. It's Mark 1, Mark 2, Mark 3, and Mark 4 instead of Volume 1, 2, 3, and 4. Because there's new GOGs in every book, new types.
Okay. And then this is the larger picture that I'm assuming is going to be on the wraparound. And, oh, my goodness, that's glorious art.
Thank you. I was thrilled with it.
I like the blown barrel. I've seen that in real life.
That's a scene from the first book. When you look at the cover, you'll see that scene. You'll read that scene.
A lot of the times, the tanks, you know, they can be salvaged. So do you factor in, because part of the early war, we were salvaging stuff from the Highway of Death from the first Gulf War and taking it back to Kuwait to be retrofitted so then we could turn it back over to the newly, you know, American-approved Iraqi military.
Absolutely. Holding the battlefield is just as important now as it was in North Africa.
So do you have them capturing the Syrian and then Iranian and whatnot gear and turning that against them too?
Some of it, yes. But we also have them going to extraordinary efforts to make sure the Syrians or the Iranians don't capture a suit.
Do you factor in the regional asymmetrical warfare that's used with like IEDs and the like, the creative guerrilla tactics?
We don't do a whole lot of that because these aren't occupying forces. These are the tip of the spear. So okay. they're not really dealing with too much except for we talk about IEDs when they're moving, advancing in some places. But most of the scenarios now, they're either on the defensive or they're where they shouldn't be so much that it's not likely it's booby-trapped.
Okay. It's definitely something to think about with the way creative people can tinker with technology and weaponize it in ways you wouldn't normally think of. You've seen some of that in the Ukraine, too, with the use of drones and the way they're doing on both sides.
Oh, absolutely. And there is a lot of this. And there's a lot of thinking about how to make things work in this war. We've got the suits. We've got rail guns. Rail guns now work as a don't have to lead it, and you can't see it firing anti-aircraft weapon that can go up 25,000 feet.
Damn.
Which creates some interesting morale problems for units that are flying in to bomb somewhere.
I bet. Wow, that gets, and then you've got the ability to get, you know, creative with some of the munitions. At one point in time, the Army was testing a 50 caliber and then a Mark 19 bullet or grenade that would airburst once it penetrated the target. So if you're shooting someone behind cover, it would penetrate the cover and then explode. So becoming, you know, at the end of the flight, it becomes a bomb. And if we were doing it in the early aughts, you have to imagine that what they can do now unofficially is way better.
Oh yeah, the shrapnel concept is being regrown and being used for penetrating bunkers and stuff. The main problem we have with it now is the material. It's difficult to produce, and we're having enough trouble just producing the regular stuff we need.
Yeah. So your 12 book arc, does this end with an independent, obviously you can't give us spoilers, but do you end with the war ending and, you know, happily ever after for now? Is that how you kind of foresee it going?
Does any war ever end with happily ever after?
No, every war, generally speaking, creates conditions for the next one.
Exactly. But what it does, well, it's called Never Again. Because after his family's killed, after other people are killed and the losses that the Republic has, they want to make sure no one can ever do this to their people again. And the only way to do that, and by the way, another gentleman had this attitude after his clan got trashed and he had to put it back together and unite with others. And eventually is you have to eliminate all the threats around you. The problem with eliminating all the threats around you is that when you move to where that threat's taken care of, there's another one beyond it unless you've encompassed the whole world. And we're not going to conquer the whole world in 12 books.
You're describing the Khan.
Yes, this is the Mongols. And that's exactly the attitude they had. And that's exactly why they did it.
And then, of course, as you displace one region, it has a domino effect down the line, even past what you're doing, which affects globally. So,
and success makes enemies.
Absolutely. I'm definitely intrigued. I'm looking forward to it. Is there anything that we, because obviously we don't want to give spoilers, and I could get nerdy about this stuff because I spent 2 years of my life there. Is there anything we didn't discuss that you think readers need to know?
It's an action book. I mean, I would estimate that 70% of the chapters, something's being shot, blown up, or chased.
Okay. For your writing style, do you find you're more like workman prose like a Tom Clancy or Clive Cussler, or do you try to get real purple with your prose like a Stephen King?
My hero is David Drake. I try to realistic clarity with altruistic characters.
I like that. Sometimes you can get too convoluted for its own sake and it can take away from the story. So
no, this isn't philosophy. This is a fiction story, a fun fiction story, I hope.
Okay. And I know Chris Kennedy Publishing, they're pretty good at a minimum finishing series. They're not one of those publishers that tend to leave you on cliffhangers because they just drop it midstream. So,
he's already talking to us about the next four.
Yeah. So I foresee that you'll be able to get your, at least your 12 book arc probably done.
Yeah. I'm working with two very talented people who are both extended veterans, very knowledgeable, and working with them to as we expand the series. In fact, the fourth book, I only have a minimal input in because it's featuring Nisty, that female character, as she develops into a major leader. And so a very talented author named Melissa Althoff is doing the bulk of the writing, because I may be a little egotistical, but I don't think after seven years, I've yet figured out women.
If you do, you'll be a very rich man.
I think I won't succeed where $3.5 billion have failed before me.
All right. So this will be out the day this episode launches. So links will be in the show notes, dear listener, to go buy it yourself. You said probably a month after this launches, the audiobook will be ready.
That's what Chris told me. So April 19th, it'll be up on Amazon and everywhere else. Never Again by me, Bill Fawcett. And then May 20th, I think, the second one, No Fail, will occur. And that really stresses the suits to their extreme with the first units that are really organized after the big war. And then about 2 months later, the Syrians don't like how well the Peshmerga and the Kurds are doing. And so with the help of the Russians, we've got another war.
So are the suits capable of being submerged, for instance? Could they become dive suits?
Nope, you can drown in them.
Okay. So that's another limitation, because there are some major waterways that go through Iraq with the two rivers.
They'll filter the air, but they don't contain it. You need a bridge. You can only go so fast. They freeze up when you fire them. They are vulnerable to many weapons. This is not Superman. This is I helped design the DC Pyro's role-playing game when it was a box game from Mayfair, my company. And no Superman. He ruins everything else. So my suits will never be Superman. They will be a great aid that is a force multiplier for real people that are in them.
So you mentioned the air, it filters the air. Given the Kurds' experience with chemical weapons, would it filter in that level, or are they still going to need a gas mask?
No, it filters on that level.
Okay.
Temporarily. You can't stay in some of the gases for more than a short period of time, or it will get through because it'll come in other parts of the suit. But you're not going to breathe it in at first.
And if you can run 35 or 30 miles an hour, you can get away pretty quickly.
That running away is a very good tactic sometimes. And they use it in some of these books.
So how can listeners that want to track you down on the internet, and we'll link it all in the show notes, dear listener, but how can they find you?
Bloodandarmor.com is probably the best place to check on this series. I'm Bill Fawcett, BillFawcett.com. And we'll be putting up a video preview. We're going to have three chapters up within the next few days. So watch on Instagram and Facebook and that, and search for Blood and Armor. And you'll probably find some more material that we're previewing out there starting tomorrow.
So I will tell you, dear listener, just because you've heard me gush about it, and I don't always do that, when I say those things, I mean it. So as soon as the audiobook comes out, I will be reviewing it for Upstream Reviews. So we can dive in, because I write reviews with Declan Finn's Upstream Reviews website, mostly because I was doing it anyway, and it's fun. So it's kind of, why not get nerdy about what you like?
Yeah. And I can't disagree at all. I was the book reviewer for Galaxy's Edge magazine for 6 years.
Yeah, we did the Why Reviews Matter episode, and I think your wife Jody was on that episode, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yes.
And you were traveling, but yeah, that's one of the things that I'm going to segue to now, dear listener. Please be kind and speak your mind. on the reviewing platforms. Your reviews help the right readers find the right books to do your part. It even matters when the authors are as seasoned and have as much of a loyal following as they do at the level Bill is, because at a certain point in time, they help tweak the algorithms. They help tell new readers why they should read it, because that's who you're talking to when you write the reviews, other readers. And if for no other reason than selfish purposes, if you get more people to like it too, he has more incentive to write more books so you can get more of what you like. So you're helping yourself as you write these reviews, people.
So. I appreciate it. I greatly would. This is my first book in 15 years.
What were you doing in the meantime besides the historical work? Were you doing games?
Working as an editor and editing, putting out, helping people to put a number of other books out for major publishers and other publishers. And designing games.
Editing is hard work too. So, all right. And you can find us, dear listener, on our Linktree, linktr.ee, Linktree/Blasters and Blades Podcast, where we link to all the things, the bit shoots, the rumbles, the YouTubes, the TikToks, the Twitters, our email, blastersandbladespodcast@gmail.com, for professional purposes only, people. We have our Blasters and Blades Facebook group and Facebook page. And more importantly, we have Madam Stabby Stab on the Instagram, Twitter, and email. Send all the shenanigans her way, but, you know, user beware, because she will make you cry, but that's not our problem. We have our website at anchor.fm/blasters-tack-and-tack-blades. Again, anchor.fm/blasters-and-blades. I will say that that will be changing soon because Spotify is requiring us to merge into their platform. As soon as I get that to work, the technology hates me. We'll get the new website up and running. We'll get it to you as quickly as we get it. But on that website, you can help keep the lights on by donating as little as 99 cents a month. Or you could support us more directly at buymeacoffee.com/author J.R. Hanley. Again, buymeacoffee.com/author J.R. Hanley. Be sure to put in the comment section that it is for the podcast, and I will keep my co-hosts duly caffeinated. They will drink until the coffee pours out of their eyeballs. And maybe they'll film it so we can see it. Thank you for spending some of your precious time with us. For my absentee co-host, I am J.R. Hanley, and this was the Blasters and Blades Podcast. We'll be back next week at the same time, where we'll indulge our love of nerd culture, cheesy jokes, and all things that go boom. Thank you for coming on, Bill. This was a lot of
fun. Thank you for having me.
I did not expect to be as intrigued by the concept. I'm like, sci-fi, I'm there. This was up. We'd have done this sooner if I had known, because this is an awesome concept.
Well, we can always come back around 3 or 4, and I'll fill you in on all the explosions in the meantime.
Absolutely. And if I could find any panel topics around future tech, we might have to drag you back for those too, because we do a lot of those panel topics.
Happy to.
All right. And with that, I'm going to hit the end button, dear listener. Thank you for stopping by.